Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-1358 et al., Portland Cement Association Petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency. Issue 1, case number 10-1359 and consolidated cases. Any SHAP issues? Mr. Phillips for industry petitioners, Mr. Durkee for EPA.
Mr. Phillips, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if that's okay. Given that there are a lot of issues and not a lot of time, I'm going to jump right in with what I would describe as the SISWI-NESHAP conundrum. Having described it that way, I apologize for my English, but unfortunately, acronyms appear to be the order of the day.
That's better than what I came up with.
The fundamental issue and the fundamental problem in the approach that the agency took to this situation is that we have two statutory schemes, one under 112, one under Section 129, the Congress clearly identified as mutually exclusive. And this court has recognized the importance of maintaining their mutual exclusivity. And thus, while the EPA was going forward in deciding how to come up with floors with respect to all of the HAPs for the Portland cement industry under Section 112, it was simultaneously trying to decide whether or not any of those particular plants were going to be subject to regulation under Section 129. And the agency was fully aware of this problem, that it was, as it was going along, it kept saying that obviously these are mutually exclusive and you can't put one in one bucket and one in the other bucket, and you can't keep one in both buckets under these circumstances. That would be clearly inconsistent with the way the statutory scheme played out. And what the agency chose to do was to simply issue a rule with respect to the 112 standards based on the sample of all of the Portland cement entities, and then subsequently adopted a separate standard for SISWI in which it essentially took out somewhere between either 18 and 53 of those plants, including a significant number of them which served as the basis for creating the floor for the Section 112 standard in the first place. And ultimately, the agency's defense to this, to my mind, sort of willful blindness as it goes through this process, is to say, well, we had no obligation to delay the final decision making with respect to 112 to take into account Section 129. And it seems to me that it's just flatly inconsistent with this court's repeated statements that all agencies have an obligation to deal with newly acquired evidence in some reasonable fashion. And whatever else you want to say about this process, this is not reasoned agency decision making. What the agency should have done is recognize that it had to figure out which buckets were going to contain which of these and which plants, and then go about the process of deciding how to set the minimum the floors based on that determination, and not simply do what I would describe as a gotcha analysis here, which is to say, well, we said we would keep them in one bucket until we promulgated the regulation, and then we jiggered the time in a way that it prevented us from having to deal with that particular problem.
What about the agency's argument that this is waived because the agency did just what it said it would do and there was no objection?
Well, the agency, I don't think, ever said that it was what it was going to do was completely allow these two statutory schemes to lose their mutual exclusivity by simply promulgating a regulation, or by not promulgating a regulation waiting 4 months to promulgate it.
Didn't it say in the proposed regulation that it was going to proceed under the assumption that everything was subject to NESHAP until further notice?
Right,
but there was no objection to that.
Right, because at that point, the industry's general view was that none of these plants should have been subject to SISWI, and that was a reasonable assumption going forward. It's only when the agency then subsequently declares in the SISWI context that 53 of these plants are subject to the SISWI standards, and therefore the buckets have changed dramatically as a consequence of that.
In the proposed regulation, didn't it give a number for how many kilns it thought would be subject to the solid waste standards, and then in the final it reduced it? I mean, did it say in the proposed regulation that some of these would eventually be subject to the other statutory scheme?
Well, there are two things to say about that. First of all, it said 53 in the notice, which was, of course, after the time for commenting on the NESHAP standards had already ended. So
no, I'm talking about in the proposed
SISWE standard. Right. But all I'm saying is that when the industry was put on notice that there was going to be a fundamental shift with respect to the solid waste standards, that was well after the period for comment had ended with respect to the NESHAP standards. And so at that stage, it seems to me it was the obligation of the agency to say, look, this is new information. We now know that a significant number of the items left in the first bucket are now moving into the second bucket, and we have a duty to take into to deal with this newly acquired evidence in some reasonable fashion. And it is not a reasonable fashion simply to ignore it and allow what at the end of the day is precisely what Congress did not intend, which is that there would be that these mutually exclusive regulatory schemes would be allowed to overlap in a way in this particular way. And it seems to me that's simply not reasoned decision making. It's decision making by gotcha, and the court ought to reject it. And it feeds then to what I would regard as sort of the second kind of conundrum that arises out of here, which is the question of what sample size EPA can use with respect to these various kilns. And to be sure, the statute's a little uncomfortable because it talks about 12% of more than 30 and 5 if there are fewer than 30, and then there's the parenthetical about the data. But the combination of the sort of KISWE problem coupled with the sample size problem is you end up in a situation where with respect to one of these hazardous pollutants, you go from 2 in the sample size to 1, and the other one you go from 3 to 2 in a scheme that almost certainly envisions at least 5 setting the sample. And the idea that you're going to have 1 or 2 serve as a model for an industry that involves dozens of plants.
What do you do about the language of the statute?
Well, the language of the statute seems to clearly envision that there would be, well, these aren't 12%, especially if you accept the idea that the SISWE changed the landscape. These are no longer 12% even under that theory. But it seems to me that the better way to reconcile it is to say there may be circumstances in which you can end up with 4 as the basis, although that seems odd to me, but that's not this case. This case doesn't have anything
at
the 4.
Is that your response to EPA's 33 hypothetical?
Yes, that is exactly my response to the 33 hypothetical. And I'll fight that one as soon as I represent an industry that has 33 representative entities inside of it. So once again, it seems to me that this is a classic illustration of not reasoned decision-making by the agency. The third issue I'd like to spend a little bit of time on is what I would call the mercury subclass or the raw materials issue. And I realize that this court's previous decisions have, in our judgment in dicta, suggested that it's perfectly permissible for EPA to take into account raw materials as the fuel and the feed for in this kind of a situation. What I would suggest is that is clearly dicta. And that if this court goes to first principles and analyzes the statutory scheme and looks at D2 and D3, where it's absolutely clear that costs are not to be included in the considerations in the one situation, and they are in the second situation, materials do not count with respect to setting the minimum floor. They do count with respect to above the floor determinations, that taking in materials into account in this context is inconsistent with the statutory scheme. And the reason it seems to me the court should go back to first principles is that in the previous cases where the court addressed this, it turned to a portion of the legislative history which it thought supported its interpretation of the statute. But recognizing that not everybody is enamored of legislative history, the statement here from the joint explanatory from the conference committee seems to me incredibly clear, because it says that EPA shall not consider the substitution of or changes in metal or mineral-bearing raw materials that are used as feedstocks or material inputs when setting emission standards. This is on page 29 of our brief. I don't know how Congress could speak more directly.
Say the court should return to first principles. Is that a way of telling us that you think Sierra Club was wrongly decided?
No, I think Sierra Club on its facts was correctly decided. That is, that the commission, excuse me, the agency was not free to rely exclusively on technology-based approaches in trying to set emissions limits. So I have no problem with that. We have clearly no quarrel with that holding. There are statements as to what considerations beyond technology ought to be taken into account, and one of the examples that's used, obviously, is the materials one. But I don't think materials was at issue in the case, and again, if you, it seems odd to me, if that had been a central issue in the case, that the court would have focused on what is clearly less relevant legislative history and ignored both the structure of the statute and the directly relevant legislative history, which seems to me at least to speak directly to this particular issue. The fourth issue I would like to focus on at this point is what I would call the MACT on MACT issue. And again, here we're dealing with the situation where we had in place in 1999 minimum standards that had been applied for particulate matter. They were on review in this court. Ultimately, this court upheld those standards because the environmental petitioners in that particular case had not adequately preserved the particular challenge. And while the court did express some misgivings about whether or not that was that rule might have been challengeable if it had not been waived under those circumstances, the court didn't strike down the rule, didn't modify it in any way. This court has recognized in the medical waste case that in situations where the court formally acts to challenge an existing floor limit, that the agency remains free under those circumstances to use the traditional 112D approach in setting those floors. But what the court has never held is that it remains for the agency to decide for itself that it thinks it made a mistake in the first instance. Because if that were the case, then it seems to me that the procedures that say that when you're going to modify an existing floor, that you have to follow different standards would be completely written out of the books.
Your point is you have to, their only choice is to proceed under D6.
Yes, Judge Taylor.
What in D6 says that? What makes D6, I mean, isn't D6 sort of a minimum? They've got to do it every 8 years, but it doesn't say that's the only way to do it.
Well, there wouldn't be much point other than, I mean, if they were going to just simply say it's something you have to do every 8 years, they would have, it seems to me, used a much less extensive provision to accomplish that. Because again, it would seem to me to make very little sense to say you're going to revisit this and do it exactly on the same standards as the D2, D3 standards, unless you're going to, in fact, employ a different set of administrative tools, which is what I think the agency itself has recognized, that it uses different tools under D6 than it uses under D2 and D3 in any event. And essentially all you're doing is saying that the D6 is limited to simply a periodic review, which I think is not a fair interpretation of that provision.
The only thing we have to go on, though, is the language of the statute, right? We don't have any cases on this yet.
There are no cases on this.
There's no cases on this.
I don't disagree with that.
Wait a minute, you would? Oh, you don't disagree?
I don't disagree with that, no, Your Honor.
So it's just a question of looking at the language.
But it does seem to me that the structure of this, I mean, you can look at the language, it still seems to me that the structure of the statute by requiring this insists that the agency approach the eight-year analysis differently than it would approach it in the first instance. And indeed, that's, you know, in a lot of ways, that's sort of central to the way the court looked at it in medical waste, because it sort of assumed that that there would be a separate analysis, but for the fact that the agency's decision had in fact been reviewed and declared to be suspect by this court. None of that would have seemed to me particularly relevant if the court were going to ultimately conclude that the D6 process that there is no difference to the D6 process versus the D2, D3 in that particular context. Realizing that it's going to be hard to get through all of the issues that are laid out here, let me suggest I'd like to just touch on three more before I cede the podium to my colleagues. What I think is a fundamentally important one is the pollutant by pollutant approach that EPA has adopted, and the reason why this doesn't satisfy notions of reasoned decision making is that if you approach it pollutant by pollutant with the stringent standards that EPA has otherwise adopted here and do this kind of a mix and match approach, you end up in a situation where no existing plant can achieve any of these in combination. And EPA doesn't really deny that. It simply says...
Did you just say that's what the record shows? That?
Well, I think it's a serious question as to whether any of them could, because you're doing an enormous mix and match among all of them.
Well, do you assert that they can't?
I don't know that I could assert that none of them could. I do think I can fairly assert that the vast majority could not. And I don't know that there's any evidence. I don't think there's any evidence that any of them could.
But where would we find, so there's no evidence either way in the record?
Right. And under those circumstances, it seems to me you cannot adopt a scheme unless you're confident that it is achievable, because that's part of the statutory requirement in this particular context. And actually, EPA's only answer to this is that it's been waived, essentially. I mean, that's their primary answer.
Yeah.
And the response to that is that, back when the pollution by pollution approach was taken, and where the standard that was set was one that was favorable to the industry, and the pollution by pollution approach was irrelevant to the industry, there was no reason to have opposed it at that under those circumstances. Now, when you combine changing the regulatory standard significantly and imposing a pollution by pollution requirement in the way that EPA has, you clearly end up with what I would regard as not reasoned decision making. The last two points I'd make with respect to the monovent, we argued there that there was no notice. They've now compelled something that's going to put that company out of business. That's absolutely clear. The agency recognizes that and said, well, maybe we'll give you an exemption later on. At that point, it's too late. The investment will already have been made. And finally, with respect to the clinker storage, the agency recognizes it didn't provide a notice of proposed rulemaking. It adopted a rule, and now it just asked the court to sort of ignore that fact. The solution to that problem, obviously, is to vacate the rule and force the commission to comply with the APA. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Durr.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Dan Durkee from the United States Department of Justice. With me at council table is Steve Silverman from EPA's Office of General Counsel and Monique Peoples from the United States Department of Justice, who will argue the second case.
Yes. Could I just ask you to respond to Mr. Phillips' last point?
Yes, the clinker.
Yeah. I mean, what possible reason is there for not staying?
Well, the proposal, EPA asked for information on which to set a standard for clinker cooler piles. The only information that was provided was from sites in California. EPA found out about that. EPA got that information, set the standard. After that, EPA found that there's other open clinker piles in the country, more information. So EPA agreed that while the industry had notice of EPA's intent or the possibility that a standard would be promulgated, the specific standard wasn't fairly noticed, and that's what EPA is reconsidering. But that doesn't.
I understand that, but my question was, why? What's the reason for not staying it in the meantime?
Well, because the standard at the time, there's no reason for EPA to question the standard at the time. EPA relied on the information that it had. It received no.
But I assume you're now going to do this again and give notice, right?
Well, that's what the reconsideration process is.
The agency might, based on new evidence, change its position, right?
It could
change the standard, and in the meantime, Kilns would have had to comply with a standard that will be changed, right?
Well, it is. I can't prejudge what the standard would be on reconsideration.
Well, that's my whole point. They can't either. So, I mean, aren't they facing sort of a situation where, they are now required to make investments that, after notice and hearing, they may not be required to make?
Well, but this was within industry's control, because EPA specifically asked for data. Industry was silent. It allowed EPA to go forward based on the smaller subset of data it had. There's no question that the standard that was promulgated was correct based on that smaller set, and EPA and industry only came in later and said, oh, wait a minute, now we have more information. So EPA was correct to reconsider on that basis, but PCA doesn't come into this with clean hands. PCA could have and should have provided the information at the time when asked for it. If I could turn then to the other arguments, I'll go in, I'll work my way backwards since we started with the last one.
You want. I didn't mean to switch your.
That's okay.
Yeah, can I take you back to the CISWE NESHAP conundrum?
Yeah. Sure.
It appears that you acknowledge that these are mutually exclusive and that the exclusivity runs both ways. So then, if that's the case, isn't counsel correct that you distort the best performing percentage when you take out a large group of these units?
No, I disagree with that. They are mutually exclusive in the sense that a particular unit, a plant, a facility, will only be regulated under one or the other. You're not regulated under both. But here, the question is, at the time EPA issued the NESHAP, what information did it have? What was the best performer? And it's undisputed that at the time EPA acted, every unit or facility in its database was a kiln, a cement kiln, and they were all subject to regulation under D-112D, not under 129. There's no way EPA could have taken any of these kilns out because it didn't have the definition, the tool with which to make that distinction. So at the time, EPA relied on the information it had. It's uncontested that that information shows they're all kilns, and the standard at the time was reasonable based on the information EPA had at the time. What PCA wants to do is take this later definition of solid waste, the tool that allows you to pull out these commercial and industrial solid waste incineration units. That's a forward-looking definition. Industry wants you to take that and look backward and say, all right, now that the emission standards are final, and now that EPA has this tool, this definition, EPA should go back in time and use that tool retroactively and say, oh, well, now it has to apply back 2 years ago. But that's not how it works.
I actually thought they were saying something different, which was that this was kind of a concurrent process, and EPA was aware that they were working on this definition and aware that it would affect the number of total units to be included under NESHAP, right? So it's not just saying, you know, if anything changes, you need to go back and apply it retroactively. It was this idea that it was concurrent. And, you know, why doesn't that make a difference?
Well, it is concurrent, but I think the difference is that while the NESHAP was being developed, all EPA had was a proposed definition. And EPA can't, it would be equally unreasonable, more unreasonable for EPA to base emission standards on a proposed definition. EPA didn't know when it was going to be finalized, didn't know what the final rule would look like, what the impact of the final rule would be. So yes, EPA was aware that this concurrent process was ongoing, but as Judge Tatel said, EPA said that. From the very beginning, EPA said, look, we got these two tracks going on. One's not done, one has to be done now. And until the definition track is finished, we're going to treat you like what you are, your kilns, and
so
you're regulated under
D. Is that your waiver argument?
That's
what... Are you still arguing that?
Yes.
You were responding to Judge Brown on the merits.
Yeah, well,
Are you still arguing that this whole issue is waived?
Yes,
I mean, forfeited?
It is waived for lack of comment, but it also goes to the reasonableness if the court reaches it, because it was reasonable for EPA... What industry wants the court to say is EPA was unreasonable because it didn't change its calculations based on a proposed rule, a proposed definition of solid waste. Our position is no, that would be unreasonable. That would be turning administrative processes on its head. You don't issue an enforceable emission standard based on a proposed definition where you don't know when it's going to be final, you don't know what the final impact is going to be. You act, and the Clean Air Act says this, 112D says, based on the information the administrator has at the time. There has to be an endpoint for EPA to issue enforceable emission standards. In this case, it's been a long time coming, and it was perfectly reasonable for EPA to say these standards need to be issued. There's a settlement agreement that both industry and environmental groups were party to that said there's a deadline by which we have to act. We're ready to go. We should finalize these standards. And EPA had no choice but to finalize them based on the information it had, which is they're all kilns. They're all subject to regulation under 112D. The only way that could change is if the definition of solid waste had already been final. That's the Boiler Mac case that industry wants you to focus on. In boilers, EPA had a definitional tool, and it applied it to divide up the universe of sources. And that definitional tool was thrown out. Chevron 1, inconsistent with the statute on its face. So the standards that flowed from that division, that application of the tool, also had to be thrown out. If the definition of solid waste in this case had been final before the NESHAP, that would be the boiler case. But that's not what happened. What happened is the definition was only proposed, and EPA should not be held to rely on a proposed definition, a proposed tool. EPA was reasonable in saying we're going to wait, and again, EPA said this consistently throughout the process, we're going to wait, and if the definition becomes final, we'll apply it. But if it doesn't become final, we have no choice but to rely on the information we have, which tells us they're all kilns, they're all subject to regulation under 112D, and the standard is calculated appropriately. I'll go on to the, unless there's more questions about that, I'll go on to the sample size, the next argument. The sample size, I think Judge Tatel's right, the statute is clear. The numbers are small in some cases, but the statute is clear that that EPA takes the information it has. And if it only has information on a small number of sources, even if it's a large source category, it has to do the top 12% of the sources it has. And industry's position is, well, that might make sense if there's 30 or 33 sources like that, but this is a source category with 158, I think, is the number they use. Well, Congress didn't say between 30 and 150, and then 150 on, you've got to use a different number. It said 30 up. So EPA, I think, reasonably said in the preambles that it had no choice. The text of the statute compels this answer. And it's not so absurd that the court should say that the clear language doesn't make any sense. On raw materials, I think...
Could you focus on the argument about D6?
D6, sure.
Yeah, would you talk about that? And just assume when you talk about it that I'm unconvinced about your argument about National Line.
I'm sorry, you're...
I'm unconvinced about your argument. Let's just assume that I'm unconvinced about
National Line. Okay. Well, I think...
Then what's the statutory argument here? That
The statutory argument is that D6 does not say that it's the exclusive means. It doesn't speak to the floor at all. The statutory language doesn't address the floor, and it certainly doesn't say that it's the exclusive means of revising the floor if the floor calculation is wrong. In fact, you asked if there were any cases. I agree there's no cases directly on point, but the court did, in passing, I think, talk about this in a case, one of the NRDC cases that dealt with 112F, and I'll let me give you the site.
What is the name of the case?
Let me give you that site. That is, it's 529 F3rd 1077. It was NRDC versus EPA from 2008. It dealt with standards under 112F, which is risk-based standards. But in the in the course of that opinion, the court did say, let me give you the spot site. The court did say that EPA is not required to recalculate the floor in the 8-year revision that's required under 112D6. Let's see.
It's not required to?
It's not required to. Now, it doesn't say that it shouldn't, but if EPA is not required to recalculate the
floor. Is that a case where the agency was proceeding under D6?
That's a case where EPA issued standards. No, it was EPA issued standards under 112F, the risk-based standards.
Oh, I see. It's a different, I see.
The standards were under 112F, not under, they were not 112D standards. Mm-hmm. Those had already been promulgated. So I agree it's not directly on point, but I think it supports EPA's statutory argument that the language of 112D doesn't control this. And we can flip over to 112D. 112D says, D6 says, the administrator shall review and revise as necessary, taking into account developments in practices, processes, and control technologies, emission standards promulgated under this section no less often than every 8 years. So it's a requirement to take a look. It doesn't say that EPA, that the administrator may only revise or shall only review. It's a shall review and revise as necessary. So it imposes a deadline every 8 years, and it gives authorization to review and revise as appropriate the standards.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what EPA did here. EPA did much what is much closer to the Medways case, where EPA said the floor calculation that you used to get the standard was flawed from the beginning, it cannot stand after this court's subsequent precedents. We have to redo it.
A national one?
Well, more clearly, BRIC, but Cement Kiln Recycling Coalition and BRIC. National Lime was the case that actually reviewed the 1999 standards itself. So the subsequent cases, Cement Kiln Recycling and BRIC are the two key ones.
Is the agency's argument that it needs a court disapproval of the existing floors to be able to proceed under D3, or is it the agency's position that if it thinks that the original floors are flawed, it can proceed again under D3?
The latter, Your Honor. The agency has that authority to review its decision, and nothing in D6 prohibits it.
So you don't depend on your use of National Lime?
No, I think
any of the other cases.
No, I National Lime is primarily useful to us, I think, in putting the case more squarely in the fact pattern of medical waste.
And what was the? And how would you identify the flaw in the original floors?
The flaw in the original floors was actually, it's the same flaw that was identified but not reached in National Lime, which is EPA looked only at the sources using the, quote, best control technology and didn't look at whether PM or other HAPS emissions were affected by non-control factors. If I could, I would like to touch on that in the context of raw materials and mercury, because I think counsel, I disagree with counsel's reading of the BRICMAC case. Counsel says BRICMAC was dicta and wants you to go back to first principles, which is going back 10 or 12 years. But I think BRIC is very clear. The difference, what BRIC stands for, among other things, is that even if the non-technology factor that affects emissions is raw materials, EPA still has to take that into account. That's the difference between BRIC and the preceding cases. National Lime talked about that but didn't reach it. Cement Kiln Recycling Coalition talked about non-technology factors, but the specific non-technology factors that Cement Kiln Recycling case talked about were fuel and other control technologies. This is at 255 F. Third, 865. The court said the fuel could have an effect, and it said that a combination of different control technologies could have effect. Raw materials was not at issue in Cement Kiln Recycling. It was directly at issue in BRICMAC. It's difficult to think of a more similar fact pattern than the industry in the BRICMAC case and the industry here. Both situations, the industry is co-located near the source of its raw materials and can't move. It's dependent on the quarry or the BRICMAC, the source of the clay. It has no choice. And the clay in BRICMAC, the limestone here, is the primary driver of the emissions, at least for mercury. And yet the court in BRICMAC said, EPA, you have to take that into account. You cannot ignore the contribution of raw materials.
But if you do that, then what's the difference between D2 and D3?
Well, that's something the court in BRICMAC grappled with, and Judge Williams grappled with in his concurrence. D3 says that the standard has to be achieved. It's whatever is achieved. Whatever sources do, whatever the best source does, that's it. And you know, the court repeatedly has chastised EPA for not recognizing that. In this case, they did recognize it. They said, okay, we'll take the data, we'll look at it, whatever is achieved by the best performers, what actually comes out of the stack, taking into account variability and statistical tools, but basically what's achieved is the starting point. From that floor level, you can go up or down, I guess. You can make it more stringent, let's say. You can make it more stringent if it's achievable to do so. In other words, if you take into account the cost of making it more stringent, is it achievable? Is it doable? That's the distinction between the two that this court has repeatedly not only said, but has criticized EPA for not following. And here we do follow it. That's exactly what we do. And now industry comes in and says, well, 10 years of case law, it doesn't work. It's not achievable. It's exactly what they're arguing, is the achievable versus achievability distinction that this court has repeatedly rejected. And I'm not saying that maybe they were right, but EPA can't ignore 10 years of this court's precedence that says that's
so
not the way to do it.
They may be correct in how they read the statute, but since we've said something different, that's what controls for EPA.
You know, if they had said that 12 years ago, maybe we'd be in a different place, but or if the cases had come out differently in 12 years ago. But EPA is not free to say, well, you know, we think industry's argument's better, we're just going to again ignore what the D.C. Circuit is saying. I would not like to see the opinion that came out of this court if EPA did that.
I actually think we've written that opinion several times.
And so it surprises me that PCA would criticize EPA for asking for that kind of opinion again. So on that issue, I'll leave that issue. And I see I'm out of time. I didn't get to, well, maybe I did get to everything. Since I'm out of time, if there's no other questions from the court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Does Mr. Phillips have any time left? All right, why don't you take 3 minutes?
Thank you, Judge Henderson. I appreciate that. I just want to make 4 points relatively quickly. Judge Tatel, you asked specifically whether or not on the pollutant-by-pollutant approach, whether any plant could comply with the proposed rule. Joint Appendix 738 is where it's pointed out, where the industry commented on this, and then there's a table that follows 738. Joint Appendix 738,
okay.
And then the table after that. If you go through the table, you'll see that none of the plants can comply with all of the requirements that are placed on there simultaneously. Second, Judge Brown, you asked about the conundrum, and it seemed to me, listening to the EPA's counsel explain how you get out of the conundrum, the answer to their problem apparently is to act like an ostrich, stick your head in the sand, and then assume that things will somehow play out as if they have no control over any of this. These are matters that are going on simultaneously. I mean, who in the world is going to say that it's reasoned decision-making to allow the same people to, with one stack of materials on one side and another stack of materials on the other side to say, well, we're not going to allow those two to interrelate, even though the statutory scheme, the statute says as plain as day, and they concede, because you have to, because the statute's clear, that these are mutually exclusive regulatory systems. And in a situation where you're dealing with both simultaneously, and you issue a notice of a proposed rule that in fact says 53 of these are going to move to a different section, it becomes incumbent on at that point. They put it in these terms and they cite no case. They say, we have no duty. I submit the court ought to say they have a duty.
What's your answer again to their argument that your client had an obligation to comment on that? In other words, that it's waived, that they didn't.
I would hope that this court would recognize. I mean, this is not a situation where EPA where the industry is laying in the weeds and somehow trying to ignore a problem. We assumed up to that point that CISWE wasn't going to apply to us at all. After the notice and comment period has ended with respect to the NESHAP rule.
But it identified 53. You just said that. Identified 53.
In the CISWE rule. So you got to keep those in mind. The timing of the sequencing of this is the NESHAP rule is proposed. They say, well, there's no CISWEs. The time for comment ends. The CISWE rule, the new proposed rule comes out, says 53 of them. We, of course, respond to the CISWE rule, and then we end up with this situation. It seems to me under those circumstances, it's not that we forfeited anything. It is that EPA refused to take into account its obligation to reconcile these two schemes when it was going to make a fundamental difference in the outcome. With respect to 112D6, Judge Tatel, I just want to go back to the language of that provision. It talks specifically about the administrator shall review and revise. Revise is a term that's used nowhere else in the statute. So if the agency is in the business of revising, it does it, what, under this section, presumably meaning B6, and it says taking into account a various set of criteria that don't involve the 12% and 5 and all that goes with that particular approach.
With respect to EPA's claim that it's okay to use one or two sources to set the standards for 150, first of all, I don't think that's the best reading of the statute, but more fundamentally, the notion that EPA cannot get any information it wants from the entities that it regulates is simply wrong, and the court ought to recognize that fact, and you shouldn't have a regulatory scheme where the floor for the entire industry is set by a single or one or two kilns under any set of circumstances. And then finally, with respect to the BRIC-MACT issue, you know, the court obviously can evaluate that for itself, but the truth is it wasn't central to the holding. I know the court said what it said, but, you know, it's interesting. EPA said nothing about either the statutory scheme or the legislative history. So it seems to me quite clear they recognize that we are right on the law, and this court should not regard itself as bound by its dicta previously and should hold to the contrary. If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.